I feel like I'm being slowly swarmed by devices.
We're all recording in various ways.
They'll be feeding on my carcass within half an hour.
I've been nominated to start us off, so I thought I'd just ask. We all had the opportunity to meet Mr. J.J. Abrams about, what was it, 5 months ago, six months ago.
Super 8.
Great. Fantastic guy. And we were just wondering, I mean, you've taken over basically a franchise that he kind of reinvigorated, and we were just wondering, with him still being a producer, how much hands-on did he have, or did he just let you do your thing?
Well, it was a little bit of both. He was very hands-on at the beginning. You know, he had worked with Tom and the writers on the script for about 9 months before I arrived, and a lot of the major set pieces of the movie, you know, were figured out. But the story was still loose enough that when I got involved, you know, he could say to me, and he did, are there any things that you would love to see in a spy film that you haven't seen? And I had a number of them. I mean, that's the kind of question any filmmaker wants to hear from a producer, you know. And I got a chance to do a lot of them in this film. So,
fantastic.
So he was very involved in the beginning. He was not very much involved during the shooting because he was busy doing Super 8 while we were on the other side of the world doing our film. But he came back in when we came back, and he responded to the rough cut and, you know, had great things to say. You know, he's a terrific filmmaker, and, you know, we were at his company, and so I enjoyed that because it reminded me of some of the looseness of Pixar, kind of a fun environment to work in.
Fantastic. And I guess you mentioned Pixar, so moving from the animation world, you've sort of gone straight into the deep end using IMAX cameras for this film. So coming to that, I mean, did that sort of history of preparation help you using IMAX cameras, or was there a completely different approach that you had to take?
I don't think it helped me specifically with IMAX cameras. I was just glad that Paramount went along with me when I said I wanted to do that. I think where it helped was that we had physically the biggest Mission Impossible film. You guys have all seen it?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You'd say, right? It's the biggest in terms of its physical size. But we did not have the biggest budget or the longest schedule, you know. So we had to be, like, really on our toes, because if we spent too much money on one thing, we wouldn't have enough money for the other. You know, we had this laundry list of things that we wanted to get on screen, and we had to be really careful that to get every dime on the screen. So that's where the animation training helped out a lot, because I only really got to pre-visualize about 2.5 sequences in the movie, and the rest I had to kind of come up with on the fly. And the fact that animation is all about pre-visualization, you know, helped me out a lot, because you know, those muscles I had already exercised. Mm-hmm. You know, I've done storyboarding for films, and so knowing how one shot is going to cut with the other is already in my, you know, background.
Cool.
Obviously, everyone's going to be talking about the Tom Cruise Dubai scene on the side of the building. Is this something that you take to Tom Cruise and say, Tom, I think I want you to go outside the building? Or does Tom Cruise go, let me go outside the building?
It's probably more of the latter. That sequence was in the film when I came on it, and you know, Tom was a producer, so there was no way that he wasn't going to do that. You know, I've been asked several times about, you know, how did you find an insurance company willing to do that? And the answer is simple: is Tom Cruise was the producer, and any insurance company that wanted the job would have to, you know, find a way to live with the idea that he's going to be swinging around that building.
when Jeremy Renner was cast in the film, there was a lot of speculation that he might actually take over the series. Is he being primed for
that's just sort of an internet thing. I don't think he's one way or the other, anything's being planned. I mean, I think everyone in this film is good enough that any one of them could take a Mission Impossible film, and that's the way Tom wanted it, you know. But this is very much an Ethan Hunt film. But that said, one of the things that attracted me to my being involved with the film was the idea that the storyline really involved, in every other Mission Impossible film, Ethan picks the team. And in this film, the team is sort of thrust on him, and then the team is isolated. So the story is about the team, you know, more so than it's about the MacGuffin or the mission specifically. It's more about a bunch of people who don't know each other that well kind of being forced to, you know, trust each other. And that was interesting to me, you know.
Yeah, I just want to know what it was like directing live-action performances coming from animation background.
Well, you direct when you record the voices in animation, and you direct the animators. Much of the world, particularly ill-informed actors, believe that the animation process, that it's some technical exercise that doesn't involve the kind of decisions that actors make, which is couldn't be further from the truth. The best animators are actors, and when you ask them about what they do, they speak in the terms that actors speak. They talk about what's the motivation, finding somebody's physicality, you know, how they walk, how they sit. The very best animation, the characters are differentiated by how they move, the way actors are differentiated. Nobody would, in silhouette, even if you made them inhabit the exact same body, you could tell John Wayne from Robert Redford by the way they moved. And the thinking process of working with actors is the same. It's just how you're dealing with them is different, because it's all happening in animation. It's split, and in live action, it's all happening at once. And I think the main difference is spontaneity. You can imitate spontaneity in animation, but it's very hard to achieve it in anything beyond the soundtrack, because it's just too time-consuming in terms of the resources. But in live action, it's all about creating an atmosphere on the set where people feel free to invent, and great things can happen out of the blue. You know, you can be going on for 3 or 4 takes and it's dead, and then somebody gets one little idea and suddenly it comes alive, and then that's something that works great there. You realize other places in the movie where it could also work. It's a very alive thing.
Awesome, thanks. For me, I want to ask you, how was the experience working with Michael Giacchino on the soundtrack, especially in the opening sequence with such an iconic main theme? How much was the care in that part?
Well, Michael loves, he is as big a fan of other composers as I am of other directors. He knows all the composers and he recognizes that the Mission Impossible theme is one of the greatest themes ever written for anything. It immediately gets your blood up. You immediately are ready to see something. You know, that music makes you so. And so when we had this idea of doing a more elaborate title sequence for the film, he was really excited about it. And he wanted to make a different version of the theme song that very much respected the original music and played with it in a good way. So it's wonderful to work with him. He not only did this Mission Impossible, but the JJ's Mission Impossible, and he did my previous movies, Ratatouille and Incredibles, and I hope that we can always work together, because he's an amazing talent.
Mm-hmm. He's a great composer. you bring up The Incredibles. I guess we can't kind of get away from this table without saying, is there any chance of a return to animation in The Incredibles? Will we see the Parr family again?
I enjoy those characters so much, but I wouldn't want to do a movie simply because it would be easy to market, or the numbers suggest that it would be successful, or whatever. The reason for sequels can be, it would have to be because I had a story that was at least as good or better than the one that we did. I mean, I don't have to look very far, even within Pixar, to see where the bar is set. You know, the Toy Story sequels are absolutely as good as the original Toy Story, and I wouldn't want an Incredibles sequel to be any less. So I have some ideas. They're not all together yet, but I wouldn't say no if the right idea occurred.
That's fantastic.
And I guess sort of flowing on from that, your previous films have all been original ideas, and you come in to this film as a franchise. It's an existing property. How much freedom do you have working in a franchise like this? And secondly, what did you want to bring to the table when you were up for the...
Well, I don't think the freedom has as much to do with the franchise as the people who are encouraging you to do it. Once I knew that Tom and JJ it's their franchise, you relax because you know that they just want to make a great time at the movies. They're not going to sit there and go, you know, there were 7 scenes where Ethan Hunt, you know, had his hair this way, so you need to have 7, you know, it's not like that. They just look at it like any moviegoer would, you know. They're sitting down with a big bowl of popcorn or bag of popcorn and are ready to be entertained, and what would do that? So their attitude is very much like my attitude. I think the main thing is that anytime that you're doing a sequel with a franchise, you're dealing with audience expectations, and instead of taking that as a burden, which it can feel like sometimes, if you take it as a tool that you can actually use. In other words, if the audience is expecting you to go left because in every film at this point you went left, you got to go right or maybe even up. Well, what would happen if you suddenly dove through the floor? You know, that's the advantage that you can take with that audience's expectations. And if you do it in a way that doesn't cheat, that stays within the characters in that universe, I think the audience is delighted by that. You know, I mean, I love it when a sequel is willing to you know, woohoo, you know.
Cute. I read an interview with Andrew Stanton the other day. He's also got his live action film coming out. And he said one of the challenges with making a live action film is he had a Pixar mentality of, we can rework this a number of times, and people in the crew sort of had a bit of an issue with that. Did you have any Pixar habits that were a challenge?
Well, you know, the great thing about Pixar is that it embraces, it's filmmaker driven. The people that run the company are filmmakers. They're not executives who are, you know, coming at it from a business school perspective. They're coming at it from the point of view of loving the medium and loving what it can do. Because it's filmmaker driven, they understand that every filmmaker has a different style, and John's way of making a movie is very different than my approach. When I came to Pixar to do The Incredibles, they actually encouraged me to do my approach, even though it didn't fit into their system as well. They actually wanted, they were afraid of falling into a rut. Even though all of their films had been successful to that point, you know, they were afraid of creating a house style that everyone has to fit into. So when I wanted to do The Incredibles, which had great heaping portions of everything CG films at the time were not supposed to do, first and foremost, a film whose entire cast is humans, which CGI was not good at that point. They just went with it, and within the animation world, I am known as a pre-planner to end all pre-planners. So, you know, we had very elaborate story reels in The Incredibles, and it was because I had a movie that was several times bigger than anything Pixar had done, but I didn't have more money. And so it was, I'm going to pre-plan every single thing so that they could build a set that would only work from this angle. If I move the camera over here, the illusion would be gone. And they were all completely gun-shy when I first went in there, because they'd say, are you sure that you're not going to want to, because they were always used to filmmakers wanting, seeing things and then wanting to change them because, oh, wouldn't it even be cooler if you're over here? And I mean, that's the way John works. He likes to build really elaborate sets and then explore them, and that's great, and his films are terrific, but I knew that if I made our film that way, we'd get a third of the way through the story and our budget would be gone. So I was willing to say, yes, I will not change from this point of view. I will, the camera will be here and I will stay right with it, and our story reels are our movie. I could show you our story reels, and they are 2D black and white versions of exactly the shot that we made. So when it came time to doing our film, where we again had a really big canvas but a tight schedule, I had already done that before. So it's a lot of wear and tear, but I'm already pre-wired to make that exchange. I'll lose some flexibility if I can do twice as big of a thing.
Yep.
Yeah.
Cool. Tom Cruise is the biggest movie star in the world, and not to mention a very passionate person when he approaches his films. What was it like directing someone like that?
Well, it's a challenge because he's very intense, and he does his homework, and he shows up on time, he knows his lines, and he expects everyone else to be, you know, this is pro ball and we came to play. That bothers maybe somebody. I don't know who it would bother, but it didn't. It's the kind of stuff that I love, because that's the way I approach it. So we got along great, and he could not have been more supportive of me doing things the way I wanted to do them. In fact, he was very good about, you know, helping me to some of the live action ways. For instance, because I had worked in animation, I was used to knowing, okay, I'm going to be on this shot, and I'm going to follow it to this point, and then we cut, and then I'll go put the camera here, and I'll follow this over here, reeling this guy's hand, and then come up to his face, and da-da-da. And so when it got to that point in the scene, I would oftentimes go, cut! And he kind of came up to me and went, you might want to keep the camera rolling a little longer, because you never know, if an actor is in a moment and something's happening, you don't want to say cut just because that's at the point where you want to change the camera angle. You want to let it, if it's happening, let it play. Mm-hmm. And because film is the cheapest part of the process. The expensive part is getting everybody there, all of the lights, all the machines, all the per diem, all the hotels and the makeup, and that's the expensive part. The film is cheap. So I very quickly learned to not call cut so quickly, and Tom was very generous with sharing his knowledge of the process, and it was great working with him.
I was just wondering if you had any advice for aspiring filmmakers or young filmmakers.
Perspiring filmmakers?
Aspiring.
I was going to offer all kinds of advice for us fellow perspiring filmmakers. I would just say, there are some nice film classes that you can take, but don't get lost in the theoretical. When I hear people come out of film school with a greater knowledge of Pauline Kael's work than David Lean's, I think there's a problem. I think that the best way to learn about film is to see films, and then to pick up a camera and make them, and be as tough on your own work as you are on the other filmmakers that you argue passionately late into the night about. But it's never been easier technologically to make a film. You could pick up that device recording me right now and make a high-resolution film. They even have Steadicam for that thing now. And, you know, that that is going to, in the financial problems of filmmaking are becoming less and less an issue as it becomes digital. So there's nothing standing between anybody and making films. And I think you watch them, and I think making them will teach you 99% of everything you need to know, and maybe 1% theory. You know? Yeah.
Great.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.